Well, hey everyone, great news. The Groove Washer is back. Well, at least in limited numbers, they're back. The Groove Washer record cleaners are made in the USA and have recently been subject to the regional shutdowns. However, the Groove Washer offices have now been given a green light for limited business. So you can now get some of those Groove Washer products, not all, but some of them, in limited numbers. Go to groovewasher.com, see what's available, and get the goods while you can. The 10% discount promotional code still works. It's VinylGuide10. Type that in on checkout. And they still do free shipping in the USA for orders of $50 or more. Look, we need to support the businesses that support our hobbies. Musicians, record shops, and vinyl accessories. So get yourself a Groove Washer record cleaner today, promo code VinylGuide10, and you'll have the best sounding records on the block. That's groovewasher.com. And with that, let's start this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide.
Hey, this is Billy Gould of Faith No More and The Talking Book. You're listening to The Vinyl Guide with Nate Goyer.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hey there, peoples. Man, oh man, thanks for tuning in. It really is a weird world, isn't it? I hope you're doing well. And I hope our little show here is a welcome distraction from the madness of the planet. This is my special time to think of my favorite hobby. I hope all of you are spinning your records a bit more than usual. I want to give a huge shout out to a couple people this week. First off, Smell from the band Segregates out of the UK. Segregates just sent me a package that contained their latest record, Preach to Me, their album Burstin', and a kick-ass t-shirt that fits my fat belly just great. I'm going to be wearing this a lot. You can check them out at segregates.co.uk. I've got an unboxing video on Instagram of that, as well as a record I just got from Kingdom Records out of Seattle. Now, Kingdom just sent me a really killer single by a band called Black Panties. You can check it out yourself. There's a limited special splatter pressing of the single at blackpantiesband.bandcamp.com. And really, thanks, guys, for sending me out those records. I always listen to whatever the listeners send, and I'll always post about it, so keep them coming. Now, it's absolutely killer when bands send me their vinyl records to check out. It's absolutely an honor to put you guys in my collection, and I do appreciate you sending them through. I get a lot of emails from non-musicians asking me how to support the Vinyl Guide podcast, and there's a few ways you can do that. We do have a Patreon page. Patreon.com/vinylguide. Joining there, you get lots of exclusive content. I put up secret episodes, extended interviews, and more. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. You could also support the sponsors of this show, great companies like AudiophileUSA.com. AudiophileUSA.com is a family-owned and operated online record shop that sells only excellent and near-mint vinyl records, so check them out at AudiophileUSA.com. You could also pick up some Seems Easy record jacket repair strips. Seems Easy is a sponsor of the Vinyl Guide podcast, and you can go there. It's Seems Easy. 2 Z's, seemseasy.com. And of course, you can check out the groovewasher.com record cleaning kit. Or look, if you're having a tough time making ends meet, and that's okay, we wish you well if you are, you can still leave us some awesome reviews on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and you can even share these episodes on social media. Putting them on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, letting your friends know about the show is a huge help to us. So if you want to show your appreciation for this podcast and for this little operation we have here, do any of those things, and it's a huge help to us. And above all, be well, be safe, and thanks heaps for listening to the Vinyl Guide podcast. And this week on the show, it's one for the books, people. We are welcoming Billy Gould, who you may know as founder and bass player of Faith No More, and he's also part of the trio Talking Book, who has a new LP that I think is really worth checking out. Talking Book 2 is a very interesting, very experimental release on Billy's own label, Cool Arrow Records. This is not a mainstream release. Now, you're likely not to hear Talking Book anywhere that you don't actively seek it. So I fully encourage you to do so. Head over to CoolArrow.com. That's Cool Arrow with a K. And there's only 500 vinyl records being pressed of this album. And then they're gone. Gone, I tell you. And you're going to cry that you missed out. So save yourself the hassle. Head over to CoolArrow.com or go to the vinyl ordering link in this episode page and pick up a vinyl copy of Talking Book 2. And by the way, if you enjoyed today's conversation with Billy Gould, man, are you in luck. We have heaps of other episodes in the Vinyl Guide archives you're going to enjoy, including episode 212 featuring Toshi Kasai and the Art of Music Production. That's episode 212 of the Vinyl Guide. Episode 189, we spoke to Michael Girard of Swans about his vinyl history and their releases. Episode 189 of the Vinyl Guide. Episodes 180 and 181 featuring Trey Spruance of Mr. Bungle, Secret Chiefs 3, and even a brief stint in Faith No More. That's episodes 180 and 181 of the Vinyl Guide. And if you like dirty ass raps, check out our conversation with Willie D of the Ghetto Boys, episode 172 of the Vinyl Guide. Heaps more on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And with that, the upfronts are done. Let's have a chat with Billy Gould of Faith No More and Talking Book. Another East Coast track. This week on the Vinyl Guide, it is Billy Gould. You may know him as founder, bass player of Faith No More, but we're going to talk about his project, Talking Book, on Cool Arrow Records. Now, Billy, I am absolutely fascinated by this project. I've found myself over recent years gravitating more towards this music, and I'm not sure what's happening for to kind of drive me towards it. Maybe it's boredom with songwriting, is, you know, the art tends to kind of be finite, but I hope maybe you could help me understand it a little bit more. How would you describe
what got me into this thing? Probably similar to probably what gets you gravitating towards it. And it's I mean, as a musician, I kind of gravitate towards things that I'm not hearing. You know, I'm looking for something that will surprise me and, I don't know, be evocative. And I just kind of felt like a lot of music, I don't know. I mean, I kind of see it from the side of being a professional musician. So I see a lot more behind the scenes than a lot of people do, a lot of the non-romantic part of it. But I also grew up listening to really evocative music that kind of, you know, took me someplace. And I felt like I wanted to be involved in something like that because it would kind of make me excited about making music.
Mm. What was the music that inspired you? Like, what was your record collection like as a kid?
Well, I mean, as a kid, I started off when I was like, I don't know, 12, 13, when I started playing bass. And it was basically the progressive rock era, probably 74, 75. And so I wanted to learn how to play bass and, you know, listen to stuff like King Crimson and Gentle Giant and Genesis and things like that. My dad was into John Lennon. So that was cool. Beatles, obviously, because I was a kid growing up with that. But I heard the Sex Pistols when I was about 15 or 16. So that all went out the window, all that progressive stuff. And I went just straight into, like, you know, writing your own songs. And I joined a band and kind of took that route. So my collection was like, I mean, if you got to think of this period of time, 1979, 1980, there was like punk rock hadn't become hardcore yet, but there was like a lot of experimental stuff happening in LA. There was a lot of small venues. There was one called the Brave Dog, where you could pay $5 to get in and all the beer you could drink. And I was probably 17. It was amazing. So I spent quite a few weekends there with really noise bands, atonal stuff. I saw Cabaret Voltaire when they first came to the States. I saw Throbbing Gristle like when I was 18. So I was into like experimental music of that era, like 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And I had a pretty big collection of stuff. And I kind of forgotten about it. It was just kind of, you know, when it got into, you know, around 2000, I still had the records, but I didn't put them on regularly, but I had them. They're still in my head. Mm-hmm. So it was easy for me to kind of think about, well, I've actually listened to this stuff quite a bit, and I've never actually tried to make it. And I met Jared, who was my first collaborator in the neighborhood, who does experimental music. I mean, that's basically his thing. And it's a different process. It's a different thing than just writing linear songs. I started helping him with some like sound stuff, like mixing his records and, you know, getting into technical things. He'd bring his files over, and we had similar tastes. So we just decided, you know, let's see what we could do. If we put both of what we knew into something, what would come out? And Talking Book was kind of what came out of that.
And when you started working with Jared, I mean, Jared, he'd had an extensive history of doing, I'm not even sure what to call it. Is it ambient?
Yeah.
Is it avant-garde music concrete? I mean, like how would you describe the music that you're creating with Jared?
I don't know. It is kind of music concrete because most of the sounds are found. He works at Ableton Live and he just knows it in a really unorthodox way. To me, it took me a while to get my head around. It's really different than I would approach things. Mm-hmm. And he's been doing it for so long. He kind of has created his own little musical language and it just really works. And so I kind of tagged along in the beginning, just kind of trying to figure out what he was doing and seeing how I could, you know, put my two cents in. And as time went on, I kind of got to know it a little bit better and hopefully was a little more of a contributor as well.
So you were at this point, and I'll say, I'm guessing the first Talking Book was 2011. So we're talking 2009, 2010 era.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably when we met.
And at that point, what I'm getting out of this is you were very much a student and really kind of learning quite a bit from Jared. What was it, a mutual journey, or was it something like he was leading you through it? What was that experience
like? Well, it was mutual because I had a studio set up and I was showing him a lot of technical things as well. Mm. Where it's like, well, what you're doing here, you could get more out of it if you did it like this, you know. And you know, when you work with these kind of things, make sure you filter out, look for this kind of stuff. And it'll feel a lot bigger. So we kind of worked together. I was just kind of being more like the engineer in the beginning. And then, you know, but once we started when we did the actual Talking Book, I think that we were both putting sounds in.
Did you have to unlearn anything or change your expectations going into this?
Completely. Completely. I mean, this is like, this kind of music is like, it's like working with clay, you know, you just work it and work it and work it till you get where you want to go with it. And it's very malleable. You do one thing and it sets everything off. Where, I don't know, my way of writing songs before that had been kind of like architecture, kind of like building a building. You know, you create foundations and you build structures on top of it. And this is not exactly like that. This is a more cyclical kind of thing where you know you're getting there when it starts feeling like you're getting there. And you don't know what that end is until you're there, and then you know that you're there. It's really different. It's a whole other world.
It sounds much more instinctual, where songwriting, you know, in the traditional sense, is a little bit more formulaic. At points, were you tempted to just grab a guitar and bass and approach it like a standard song?
No, I exactly did not want to do that. That's the last thing I wanted. I think Jared would have liked me to have done that, actually. And I did not want to go there. I really wanted to, I felt like that would have kind of like, I would have brought some of my baggage in to something and it would have somehow cheapened what we were doing. So I kind of wanted to only pitch in if I really thought that it was adding to what we were already trying to do.
Now, when you're creating this sort of music, how do you keep from, let's say, overthinking or underbaking the material?
That's the hardest, craziest part is, I mean, we started this record now that's coming out in probably 2014. We're looking at 6 years. So a couple times we're saying, are we overthinking this? But you know, if you're not feeling it, if you're not ready to let it go, then it's not finished. It's kind of like, you know, when you're there. And I mean, after like 2 or 3 years of this thing, I'm like, I mean, I don't feel like I'm there, but I kind of want to get this thing done, right? But it wasn't done. And it's just one of those things you kind of can't question the process. If you're lucky, you get it done quick. And if you're not, you know, you have to see it through. And that's just what it is. Mm. It's just, I mean, one thing that's kind of interesting that I really hadn't had happened with making music before was, you know, you're getting there when you start kind of seeing things. You start visualizing. When the music starts giving you kind of this visual component, then you know you're getting there. Then you, it's kind of like tasting when you're cooking like a chili or something and you're adding your spices. And when they all start really fitting together, then you know you're there.
Mm. The visuals that you have, because when I listen to Talking Book, I get visuals. But what I'm unclear of is, what are the other visuals that other people are drawing in their mind? Do you know if you and Jared share some of those same visuals while you're creating it?
I mean, this is really like, it's really complex stuff. I think that we know both at the same time when something's working. So we are getting something. I don't think we talk about those visuals, but our visual taste on what we do with the music, how we did the record cover, that jives very well. So I feel like we're kind of on the same page there.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure you hear people compare the music to soundtrack music, which I get the sense you encouraged simply by the packaging of the music. So yeah. I'm assuming the correlation of soundtrack music doesn't annoy you at all.
Not too much.
Okay.
It isn't, though. It's a, well, I mean, we say it's a soundtrack of a movie that hasn't been made, right?
Or one you're making in your head.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, we try to leave enough open to where we don't choke the experience, right? We don't want to, you know, precondition what somebody's going to take when they hear it. But at the same time, it's it is a visual thing. I mean, soundtrack is the only way I can put it, but I can't say that it's connected to a story necessarily. It's very unconscious stuff.
My experience with listening to soundtrack music, and I'm not an aficionado of soundtrack music by any stretch, but
okay.
I feel soundtrack music is a partial experience, and the other experience is meant to be on the big screen. But in absence of the big screen, if you're just listening to the soundtrack music, you start to make your brain starts to fill in that other part of the story.
I think that's true. Yeah, for sure.
So it could be a personal experience for everyone, but it's just a different experience of what that other half is, which, you know, I find myself being touched emotionally by instrumental music far, far more than anything with words.
I can see that. I can see that. You have a little more to work with, I think, in a strange way, because it's not being, you're not, it's, the definitions aren't quite as solid, which is a good thing. I mean, another thing, I mean, really what we're doing is, I mean, we're kind of working with feelings, you know, and that's kind of a weird way to put it, but it's this unconscious thing. It's like when something feels good, man, people have a hard time describing wine, right? What's the thing about wine that you like? It's very difficult to be subjective. But when you're getting somewhere, it's not only because you're getting somewhere on a musical level, but it's also because it's touching something inside of you that makes sense, that maybe you can't vocalize, but it is making sense to you. And we've kind of looked at like our titles, what we're actually doing after we've created kind of the songs together. And we're like, where are we going with this? Because we consciously weren't really directing it. We were following it. And mm-hmm. You kind of figure out where you were at the end of it. Like, what were you channeling in a way? And then you learn a lot about yourself actually, and what you were actually, where you were going with it.
With, I think, zero lyrics on this album. I think there may be some background chatter here and there, but where do you come up with the track titles? How do you know that, oh, this one should be called The War Was Better?
Well, because what we did was we said, okay, here's our body of work. These are all finished, and it all kind of fits together with itself as a whole. So, or as two wholes, because, we made a vinyl record that is two pieces. So one side is side A, one side B. And they're continuous pieces, right? But they all fit together. That's the point. And we were like, where are we with this? Like, what were we doing? And we kind of talked about it, like, what is the story that we made? And we kind of got into the channeling this civilization, like this breakdown of a civilization, breakdown of a society. And oddly enough, I mean, the plague was one of the things that kind of we were kind of forensically looking into what is this story that we made. And it's kind of about a plague, or either that or a kind of like an invasion, where society kind of was pretty well sophisticated and kind of broke down, and kind of personal relationships that kind of got destroyed, and the aftermath. And that's kind of what the record is. The weird thing is we came up with all this about 4 or 5 months ago, so we wouldn't have seen like this happening now. But I can definitely say that there's some real like I don't know. There's something I can feel something from now with that.
Yeah, strong correlation. Well, yeah, no need to move the release date on this one.
We're gonna get rich off of it now.
No, I'm dealing with a lot of different artists, different people. They're like, "Well, should we move the release date? What is this good? This bad? Whatever." It's like man, Talking Book. It just sounds very timely if that's the case.
I mean, I hate to be the silver linings guy because what's happening is kind of it's really a shitty thing. But I mean, it's a destruction. I mean, it's catastrophic. But I mean, people are home and they're sitting at home and it actually. Life is slowing down enough where maybe it's easier to listen to a whole album like this than it would have been a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, maybe it makes sense to come out now just in the fact that people are a little more open to hearing it.
Yeah. Everyone has this now, this permission to spend a bit more time on things like this. And that's, absolutely. You know, that allowed me when I've been listening to the digital files, absolutely. Well, let's talk about the record because you sure. Mentioned it's two sides, obviously. Is it the same material just seeing together as the digital files? Do you see it as two pieces?
I do. I see it really as one whole piece, like with the intermission would be turning the record over. But it actually, all songs string together. There are no gaps. So yes, it is one whole journey.
Would you see yourself and Jared at some point doing actual soundtrack work, like working on a film? Because it feels like you have all the elements and the emotional connectivity to do so. Is that something you would see this project one day having that visual collaboration as well?
I could see that. The only thing that would be different is there would be something that we'd be conforming to. And with this so far, there haven't been anything to conform to. We've kind of create the story with the music. So it would be a little bit opposite, backwards in a strange way. But I think that we could probably do it. It would be a little bit of a different approach. I mean, I think technically we could do it. I don't think there's a problem there. But I think that the spirit of kind of how we're doing this would be a little different because it'd have to make sense of something that already exists.
Yeah. You're more than likely trying to fit into someone else's vision rather than them making visuals to yours.
I mean, we really tried. I mean, like I said, this is kind of like a more of a discovery process. We were kind of trying to learn why we were going where we were going. And when you have a kind of a format and a map in place, why not, right? But it would be a little different than how we've done it up to this point.
This album's coming out on vinyl. You're pressing 500 units, which is a very, very conservative number. And then they're gone.
Right.
Are there any other surprises with the vinyl other than the music, the format we're used to? Are there any other things in this vinyl package?
Not really. It just the best thing about it is that you can listen to them like they were intended and it's like played through from top to bottom. And the other thing about it really is that we only made 500 because the people who really want them, they can get them. And that's the special part right there.
Right.
I think there is a difference. I think there's a difference in how it's going to feel. But that's it. And the artwork looks better on a larger size, of course.
And this is being released from Cool Arrow Records, which is your imprint, yeah. What's it like managing a record label in 2020?
I'm going on like 20 years, so yes, it's changed. I mean, it's all based on streaming now. I mean, basically, the industry is based on streaming, and streaming has to do with getting on the major digital services and. Tell you that people don't really need me to be able to do that. There's plenty of ways to get onto iTunes and Spotify without going through a record label like mine. Mm-hmm. It's great having a platform and a nice distributor where when I have an idea or I find something that's really cool that's not getting the support it needs, that I can jump on it and be part of it. So it's kind of a semi-creative endeavor for me.
And I've noticed Cool Arrow, it doesn't necessarily have a niche. At least not one that I can see.
No.
How do you describe, I guess, the music that your label makes to others?
Well, that's kind of how I got into it. When Faith No More broke up, I still wanted to work with music, but I didn't have a band. And a label, I've been touring a lot with Faith No More, so I'd seen a lot of great bands from all over the place. And most of them, outside of the States, nobody had ever heard of. I hadn't heard of them, and I look for it. And I was like, man, you know, these guys, people in the States should know about this. So I started this label just thinking, I'm just going to find stuff. I didn't look at it like genre specific. I looked at more like this quality here that I want to try to build a pipeline for bringing quality in so that there's American access to some of these bands. So I looked at it like that. I mean, I didn't know anything about a label. I didn't know the business really on the retail side. So I didn't realize what a stupid idea that was if I wanted to survive, right? But from an idealist perspective, it's also kind of what's kept me doing it 20 years, is because that isn't the driving force of me doing a label. The driving force was kind of helping things that needed help, if I could help. And I try to limit it a little bit to about 2 or 3 releases max per year, because I don't want it to get in the way of my real creative life. But you know, I think the genre thing, it probably would have helped me a little bit if I would have narrowed it down in the very beginning, but I'm really kind of in a way glad I didn't, because I think that as a person and for what I put my time into, I think it's a little more rewarding.
Some of the artists that you have on your label, Deboja Collective,
right.
I saw them a few years ago in Australia, and they were incredible. And this is a band I'd love to have more people know about. I was delighted to see them, that they were on your label. How do you find a band like this out of Sarajevo?
I went to Sarajevo about 1995, when the war was just ending, and hung out at some, I think I was there the night the war officially ended. I was there, I was in town, and I went to some bar, and, you know, as you do, you know, having fun. And I met a veteran. I think I met him, or I met his friends, but I hung out with his friends and then made it back to Sarajevo about a decade later. And he came to our gig. I was with a band called Harmful, a German band. I was playing guitar, and we were talking, and he was telling me about his band and how they just were hitting this wall where they had these great material. They had these great ideas, and they were kind of like, how do we get out of this ceiling that's Bosnia and get into Europe and start touring? And, you know, got me having the conversation with them where we just kept talking, and I was kind of just giving them advice in the beginning. And it came to a point where it's like, okay, I'm going to see if I can help you guys. Let's see if we can work together. Let's see what we can do. And that's how my association started with those guys. And I got to say, it's really rewarding. They are an amazing, amazing group. And they could be an inspiration to a lot of bands, because these guys are touring machines. Hmm. They appreciate what they're doing, and it is a pleasure to work with a band like that.
Yeah, I'm going to put a link to some of their videos in this episode page, because there's someone that I'd love to see get greater exposure as well. So running Cool Arrow, is there a lot of vinyl that's being produced from Cool Arrow? Would you say maybe half your artists make it to physical media? What's the approach to vinyl?
Not as much vinyl as I would like, because, well, I mean, a lot of stuff I do is kind of like, and this is a band from Chile. I've done quite about 3 vinyls with them now. They're called Como Asesinar a Felipes. I love them too. They're great. They're almost jazz. They're very, very experimental. They kind of have their own little musical language. They're very well respected in Chile. I don't know how. I think it's starting to work now outside. But the point is, you know, when you do vinyls, this is a lot of volume that, you know, either you're storing in your house, or at the distributor, and you're paying rental space. So it's a tricky situation, because I would like to work with vinyl more, but I have to pick and choose my battles in a way.
Are there certain bands or geographies that tend to be more receptive to vinyl? Like you mentioned Chile, I would imagine that
that's a good question.
Vinyl is probably not as popular there as it is like in Europe. Have you seen any sort of rhythms or trends like that?
I think that vinyl is fairly popular in South America, but it's getting the vinyl there that's the problem, because you have to ship it. Mm. So there was a vinyl plant that was opening up in Chile. The guy, the old Channel One, He bought all the Channel One gear from Jamaica, and he was up and running. I was really excited because I could start working with more bands down there and releasing. Otherwise, things were getting pressed in UK or US and getting shipped down to South America. And by the time it got there, it was so cost prohibitive, it almost wasn't worth it. And they folded, unfortunately. So I think that there are people that would like vinyl there. I just don't think that they can actually get it. Now, UK, we do okay in UK. And one of the reasons is also probably because our distributor is based out of there. Mm-hmm. So I can't really say which markets are better than others because there's a little bit of bias and what's more accessible with the delivery system.
I want to remind folks they can go to coolarrow.com. That's cool with a K. coolarrow.com, and there's all these bands listed there, including Talking Book, and the links to be able to purchase one of the limited 500 vinyl pressings of Talking Book. Now, it's been 9 years since the last Talking Book album. How have things changed? How's it evolved? How's the project evolved since the first release?
Well, we put the record out, the first one, thinking, I'd never thought we'd ever do any live shows. I mean, it was just kind of like, let's get this thing done. Let's see what we can do. And then about a couple months after the release, Mike Patton had a project with Anthony Pateras that he was doing in SF. And he asked me if we wanted to open for them. And we're like, holy shit, how do you play this live? Right. And it made us kind of get into it. We actually spent some time and focused on it. And we did it live. And we're like, wow, we can actually do this. We could actually make this a thing. So we did a couple tours with it. And Jared had worked with the guy Dominic Cramp on a lot of his other projects. And he was saying it would make a lot of sense to bring Dom in because this is kind of crazy for two people to do. And Dom and him had been working together already. Dom knew the vibe and the process. And he kind of jumped in. It was pretty seamless, I'd have to say. And since then, Dom's been kind of the member of the band. And we did some touring. We did a South America tour where we kind of really started getting a great chemistry where we could improvise with this and still make it faithful to the record. And we came back and we're like, man, let's do it. Let's just record what we have. It's almost like a live record, you know? We have all this material. And then my studio had this flood where they just ripped. They saved all my gear. I wasn't even there. I was gone when it happened. I was on tour. They saved my gear, but they ripped everything out to save it. So everything was in a room, like in a pile. Right. And that took about 8 months, I would say, to really get it going like a studio again. It takes a while, you know, to dial that stuff in. And you know, of course, you get the stuff ripped out and you're like, well, I could probably rather, I always wanted to replace this thing anyway, right? And you know how it goes. So the time we got back was like, you know, this music that we had that we were ready to go was like, our heads had kind of already kind of moved on a little bit from that. And we're like, well, what if we do this? And all of a sudden there's the can of worms and, you know, we're off to the races.
Okay.
6 years later, here we are.
Record speed.
Exactly.
Now, how is working with Talking Book and creating this sort of music, how is that influencing the other music that you're creating in your other projects?
Oh boy. I mean, I think all of this stuff all collects. It's all just the way you hear things, the way you blend things, the way, to be honest with Faith No More stuff. I mean, I could say with this Talking Book stuff, there's certain moments that I feel that they move me, you know, and I go back to Faith No More. It's like, well, if it doesn't move me like this, then it's not good enough. Like, I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing, but I think it raises the bar a little bit because Faith No More music really doesn't have a lot in common with Talking Book, but there are certain levels of satisfaction you get that you want to be able to bring into the other project too.
It's raising your level of expectation.
Yes, and level of detail, which could be a bad thing, possibly. But, you know, it's kind of like once you have a good coffee, you know, it's hard to go back, right?
Yeah.
Once you know the difference, you want the difference. You hear it. So, you know, you get this kind of more critical way of listening. I mean, Talking Book is all critical listening. It's all like what's not working, how do we blend this, how do we form it, how do we refine this and make it better. And you know, it's a double-edged sword, I would say.
You can't keep them on the farm once they've seen Perry.
Exactly. That's it right there.
So what other music are you creating, Billy?
Right now I'm mixing. I'm doing one of the bands on my label, Como Sonar Felipes. I'm just about to do a mix for their thing, and they went in a completely different direction, which I'm excited about. And these files are coming in any day. Other than that, I've kind of a bunch of stuff that probably too early to talk about. So I probably best not to start talking about things that aren't near completion. So some stuff, I'm always working.
Fair enough. So I'm going to ask you a few questions about some of your vinyl history. Okay. I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong here, your first appearance on a vinyl record was not Faith No More, not even Faith No Man. It was The Animated. Is that correct?
This is the vinyl guy.
That's right.
Yes, it is. It absolutely is.
We're going spelunking.
I was probably 17 when we recorded that. Yeah. And that was a band I was in L.A. That was my first band I was talking about earlier that I was in. It started with a kid I met in Boy Scouts who was learning guitar. Turned out to be a bunch of guys who were his friends. We rehearsed in his living room. And one of them ended up being Mark Stewart, who's known as Stu. He's there's a film called Passing Strange that Spike Lee did. He composed, and he's actually quite successful now as a composer. And Chuck Mosley, who was the singer for Faith No More, he was the keyboard player in the band. So we had this thing that we were really excited about that kind of sounded like a cross between the Buzzcocks. I would say a cross between the Buzzcocks, maybe Squeeze, and throw some Michael Jackson in there. It was a weird thing. We couldn't get gigs. We didn't fit in. We were definitely black sheep. But we were really into it at the time. And so that was that EP. Yep.
And at 17 years old, I mean, that's quite advanced for a 17-year-old to be in a band that makes a record. Like, what was the approach? Was everyone just kind of pitching in a couple $100 to get these pressed up somewhere?
The guy who was the manager of the band had a friend somehow who owed him a favor, who said he could get studio time in a studio from like midnight till 6 a.m. So we would go into the studio in LA like from like midnight to 6 and record for free. And that's how we got that done.
And I imagine the vinyl run was probably 500, maybe
300. I think it was 300. And, when it came out and after it was pressed, I took some with me to go to the UK. This is when I graduated from high school, to try to find distribution or a record deal. So I spent a month in London going around looking for a record deal and found a distributor and just told them we were going to be coming there on tour. And there was no way we were going to be coming there on tour. So I would call every once in a while to see how the record's doing. And they'd always say, when's the tour? When's the tour? Oh, yeah, it's coming. It's coming. I don't know what happened. I'm sure there's a warehouse or some basement someplace with some old vinyl records.
Your next 7-inch, I believe, was in 83, Faith No Man.
Correct.
Quiet in Heaven, Song of Liberty. Okay.
That's
so
right.
How many of those were pressed and what were the expectations on that?
Another short one. Very low expectations. We probably played gigs for, on a good night, maybe 15, 20 people. So we wanted to do it. We needed to do it. We felt the only way forward is by recording. Demo tapes weren't getting us gigs. So maybe a vinyl would. It was the only thing it was our only option, really. That was done at Matt Wallace's studio, who ended up doing all the Faith No More stuff. He lived with his parents. And they let him use their garage as a recording studio. So he had this really primitive 8-track setup. And we came there and recorded there. I think I still have the receipt from that, actually. It was like $40 or something like that.
And how many of those did you get printed up? Do you remember?
I think it was 250 maybe more. I don't know. I'd have to look it up. I think I do have the receipts to those.
Oh, wow. Okay. You, you file a lot of things then, sounds like.
Yeah. Or they just, I don't throw away a lot of things. Yeah. I mean, they're all stuck in a trunk, you know? I mean, I've got to wade through them.
And then, Mike Borden was in the band at that point. Right. Exactly. But Chuck wasn't.
Chuck was not for a couple of years. Though I stayed in touch with Chuck because he was still in that band that I had left the band, The Animated, to go to school up in Northern California. And I kept in touch because those guys were really good friends. And you know, if I go down to LA to visit, I'd hang out with Chuck. But he kind of was just a guy that hung out with the band and just buddies. And we had a gig in LA that we booked where we didn't have a singer. And we just, you know, he was sitting there outside. He had a 40-ouncer of malt liquor. And he was, you know, he was feeling good. And we were like, just get on stage and start yelling some stuff. And he's like, yeah, all right, I'll do it. And he actually kind of had a musical approach to it. We liked it. So we asked him to do it again, and it just kind of became a thing. And that's kind of how he became our singer.
And
yeah.
Not too long after that, you guys had a deal with Mordom Records?
Right. That was a couple of years later. We'd been through about 7 guitarists and probably 4-5 singers. But Chuck was the one that had stuck.
Was Courtney Love pre Chuck or post Chuck?
Pre-Chuck. Okay. She was pre-Chuck. Once we got Chuck, we kind of stayed with Chuck.
Okay.
And yes, Mordom Records was Ruth Schwartz, who worked on a radio show called Maximum Rock and Roll. And she worked on the magazine Maximum Rock and Roll. Mm-hmm. She had a friend who worked at Rough Trade who had, I believe, had told her about us. And well, we had this kind of theory, and I guess the theory kind of worked where, you know, really, since like 1982 till about 1985, people weren't seeing us. Our music was weird. We couldn't play with punk bands. We couldn't really play with much of anybody. We had our little crowd, but it was very small. I was thinking, you know, we got to get into these clubs where these like European bands are playing, and how are we going to do that? And I just had this theory like, well, if we can have a really good recording, right? If we can just get something that's recorded well, maybe people will look at us a little differently because our stuff sounds like just bad demos, like any other bad demo. Mm-hmm. So we got Matt and we saved up all the money we had. We just scrounged together and we recorded like 4 songs. And that ended up being what Ruth Schwartz heard to put the record out. She heard it and she's like, as soon as she heard it, she called me up like 2 days later and was like, I like this music. I want to put it out as my first record on my label. So it went really fast, actually, once we got that recording done. Mm. The theory actually held water. Anyway, we were doing all kinds of desperate scheming, you know, and that was the one that stuck.
Well, desperate times call for desperate measures.
You know it.
Because I always found it extremely interesting and hilarious that Faith No More had this very eclectic, very... I'll call it left of center style, but then had this cover of Commodore's Easy. Uh-huh. To me, it was just a great irony. Was that the intent? I mean, whose idea was that cover? And was there any resistance from the band in doing that?
No, it was a spontaneous, like, we have to do that song. I think what happened was, I mean, we all came from really different backgrounds. You heard my history, you know. When I was playing in The Animated, I was seeing Throbbing Gristle and going to punk shows and like noise shows, and everybody kind of had really diverse backgrounds. Our record collections were very varied. We had a lot of old Jamaican stuff we listened to, a lot of dub, and you know, we started playing with Faith No More, and Jim was a metal guitar player, and we did a cover of War Pigs, and so we kind of got thought of as this metal band, and a lot of metal people started gravitating towards us, which was fine. But I kind of started feeling like, you know, people were kind of defining us as something that we really weren't. Like, we really, yeah, we like a lot of metal music, but we're not like a metal orthodox metal band. You know, we like to do whatever we want to do. Our record collections are varied, you know? And so we like, this is easy is the perfect way to kind of like put some cold water on some of that shit. And we first did it live and people just couldn't get it. They couldn't deal. And it was like, we're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
We're buying some freedom for ourselves, you know? That's pretty much it.
Now, in terms of your musical collection, do you still listen to vinyl? Do you have a record collection you visit regularly, or are you kind of gravitated toward digital?
I have a record collection. I have a pretty nice record collection, but my equipment has been like, my turntable has been down for a couple of years now. So I'm looking at it every day, and I'm not hearing it. And it's actually, we're just in the process of doing something about it. I'm getting it fixed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's really, I'm a bad, bad vinyl guy. Very bad.
This is not the time in history where you want to be sealed up in your house and the record player's broken.
No, but at the same time, I think if we can fix it ourselves, then I think this is the time we have the time to actually focus and do it and get our shit together.
Is it something you could fix yourself, or do you need parts?
If I can't, my wife can, because she can fix anything.
Billy, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide, sharing with us your vinyl history, and of course, talking about Talking Book, which is really interesting release. I'm enjoying it, and it's teaching me something new, which is every day I learn something, I'm always very excited, and this is something that I'm keen to explore, this sort of music. And I think Talking Book is probably one of those gateway albums that will get me exploring a bit more. I want to make sure the audience knows they can check out Talking Book. The new release is Talking Book 2. It's available on vinyl, 500 units only, and then it's done at Cool Arrow Records. That's coolarrow.com, Cool Arrow with a K. And we're going to also be talking to Jared shortly about this as well. Is it fair to call him the other half or another third?
Absolutely. Another third, but I mean, he's really the reason I started it. Me and him together, or with the, you know, knocking our heads together, was the core of why we're here. So he's a big part of it.
Thanks, Billy.
Thank you. Okay, take care.
All right, there we go. Mr. Billy Gould of Talking Book, Faith No More, and Cool Arrow Records. Head over to coolarrow.com. That's Cool Arrow with a K, coolarrow.com. Pick up one of the extremely limited vinyl pressings of Talking Book 2. It's a marvelous album. Head over now and get them before they're gone. Oh yeah, and don't go too far, because our next episode is going to be with Jared Bloom of Talking Book. That's Billy's audio partner in this project. Again, another great conversation here on The Vinyl Guide. All right, and that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. We'll be back really soon with a brand new episode. Don't you worry. In the meantime, share this episode on your social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Write us a nice review on Apple iTunes. Be a good person. Wash your hands. And we'll be back with a brand new episode shortly. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @VinylGuide. Until next time, keep spinning.